There was a last-minute addition to our bulletin. I'm not sure if you all got a copy of this. If you want, there's some at the back. If you didn't get it, it's just an outline, more or less, of Romans 12, 1 to 3, and more or less an outline of what I'll be talking about today, either for you to take notes, if that's helpful for you, or to take home and jog your memory with later, if that's of interest to you. You'll notice on the top that I entitled this, How Then Shall We Live? You might be aware of books. I'm aware of at least one book that has that title, How Then Shall We Live? And that's Paul. They're probably going from Paul, and Paul probably got that from someone else. But it's a logical, it's an exciting place to be in the book of Romans, because though Paul has been telling us that we should be doing certain things like, since you're dead to sin in Christ through your baptism, then consider yourselves dead to sin. He really has not targeted the practical questions like, well, what does that look like? What does being dead look like, dead to sin look like when I'm having breakfast, when I'm, you know, doing any number of things? And Paul is also, and so he's a very practical-minded guy. He just needs to get the thinking straight first, as we're going to hear. That's an important part of this journey, being transformed by the renewing of our mind. So Paul wants to get there. He just has to lay the foundation, and he has in the first 11 chapters of Romans. So the therefore that begins chapter 12 is looking back and basing a conclusion on of what all that he said from chapter, halfway through chapter 1 or so, up until Romans 11. All of this great teaching about what God has done for us in Jesus Christ, the theological questions associated with that, like what about the law, what about the Jewish people, Paul has dealt with all those, and now he's saying, okay, here's where the rubber meets the road. How then shall we live? Well, here's the answer. In part, it's a question because Paul has more or less displaced the Mosaic code, the law which governed all of life, by tying, you might remember this, in Romans 7, Paul makes an unholy trinity of the law, sin, and death. And that would have been scandalous and outrageous to your Jewish mind and ear, still would be, I would assume, a religious Jewish person. But for Paul, it's very clear that the law existed to make sin so desperately sinful that we would give up on this broken project of trying to be righteous before God on our own efforts, our own merits, our own goodness, inherent or earned or otherwise. And so, but there's this logical question that, Paul, if you get rid of all these rules, people are just going to do whatever the heck they want. There's going to be pandemonium, and people are just going to be self-indulgent. And I've actually had conversations with people when I'm stressing the love of God and the importance of connecting with the love of God and the mercy and grace of God. And they're like, the response is, if I were to do that, I'm afraid I would just do nothing then. And what they're betraying or what they're indicating in that comment is that they motivate themselves, and they are motivated by guilt, shame, and fear, and perhaps a sense of duty, if that's at all different than shame, guilt, and fear. And they miss this point. Do you remember two-year-olds or three-year-olds? No, I could be wrong and very romantic and idealistic about this. But my understanding is, my sense is that a child who's that age just wants to please mom and dad. You don't have to guilt them into it. They're not perfect. They make mistakes. They get distracted. Sure, lots of these things. But what a thrill it is for a little child to be able to run in and go, mommy, mommy, or daddy, daddy, look what I did. And for you to go, that's amazing. That's it. Their day's been made, right? But there's no higher pinnacle for them to earn that well done, thou good and faithful servant, to use scriptural wording. Most of us don't believe that anymore because that dies in the child, because 16-year-olds don't seem to have the same instinct. So somewhere we miss that. But that's how we are in relationship to God. If we could only be free before God, our only desire would be to please him. But we bring with us all sorts of baggage and clutter. And the law was put in place both to point that out and to make it an impossible project. But we're stubborn enough, and it runs deep enough in us that it's very hard for us to get away from that sort of thinking, that sort of motivation. But that's Paul's whole point in Romans. You've been, as he says in Galatians, it was for freedom that you've been set free in Christ. Therefore, live in that freedom. Guard that freedom. Don't let anything take that freedom away. And that freedom is the freedom of love. It's the freedom the child has, who's the loved child, the accepted child. The freedom to just come in, to be, to receive, to confess. Sure, there's a need for confession. There's still going to be sin and mistakes, but how you manage that is a vast difference between a legalistic or a shame-based and guilt-based approach to life and the life of freedom, the life of love, the life of grace and mercy. And so Paul is clearly trying to steer us into this one side. And so he says, it's really a simple question. What about the law? The law is only always going to limit you and hamper you. It's always going to constrict you. So you're not losing anything when you lose the law, if you're motivated by the love of God. So don't be conformed to this world. That is, don't let the world tell you what's important or how to live. Now, I think, I'm pretty clear, and because I said this in the early service, I have to say it in this service, this evil little thing, and this is an evil little thing, right? Evil incarnate, not entirely, but if you're on this machine, shame, base, guilt, duty, all sorts of things are the primary mode of this. They tell you you lack, you're insufficient, or you're wrong, or they scare you. Did I say fear? Fear is another one of those motivators. Virtually, I don't know, 100%, 90% of that is on there. And when you count advertising, which uses this to sell a product, you've got what the world tells you how to live. The world tells you what's most important, of course, is to look good and to look better than your neighbor, whether that's your house, your lawn, your car, your kids, your lawn tractor, your dress, like how you dress yourself. All of these things, they tell you you're not enough, you're insufficient. That's the way our world works. That's the way capitalist market works. It's our whole culture is built on it. And as Christians, it's very hard to live differently. But Paul says, don't be conformed anymore. The Greek word conformed there is the idea of acting as if you were something. Taking something that's not a real value and calling it a value. I want to say it's essentially, because I get to quote Kierkegaard if I say this. Kierkegaard, in his analysis of despair, he says, despair, to be in despair is to be unwilling to be the self that you are. To be in despair is to want to be a self that you aren't. You deny the self you are because you always are choosing to be some self that you're not. And that's, I think, an interesting commentary on human existence. And that's what Jesus came to remove from the human condition, is that drive and that need to believe and to accept that if I just got this thing, one more advance, one more raise, one more dollar in my account, one more car in my, or one more garage bay in my garage so that I can park one more car, all of these things, and I'm going to be good, I'm going to have it made. And it's absolutely false. Now, you don't need to try that on cars and houses and garages. You can just try that on your toothpaste. Go watch the toothpaste ads and then try that. You'd be like, you know, since I switched to Crest, man, my social life got revolutionized. If that's true, go for it. Like, you've got the golden goose there. Like, run with that. And you can just keep buying stuff, consumers tell you. If it's not true, why would you believe it about cars and about jobs and about houses and about, right? Does that make sense? You can try this. It's false. These are empty values. And Paul says, don't choose those values, but be transformed in your inner being, the real person, being made new, being transformed. And it's a different word than the conform. The conform is external, pretend to be. This is genuine, real stuff happening. And the key is the transformation comes through the renewing of the mind. The renewing of the mind. Now here's somewhere that you can intersect with this. A lot of this is what God is doing and God has done. And it's important that we know that and recognize that. But you can choose. In fact, you're 100% responsible for what you allow into here. Now, there's tapes running, but they're already in there. You're not always responsible for those. You can find the pause button, perhaps. But what you're putting into this, you're 100% responsible for that. Do you remember the little documentary called Supersize Me? I never saw it, but you don't need to see it. You just need to know the premise. Some guy built a documentary, filmed himself going around to McDonald's. He would order something, and every time they said, would you like to supersize that? He would say, yes, supersize me. And he was going to do it for a year and see what happened. Now, after, I think, 3 months or so, his doctor told him, you need to quit because you're killing yourself. We live on a diet of fast food for the brain. And we need a documentary if somebody goes around and like grabs all this drivel that counts as information and knowledge in our culture today and says, yeah, supersize me. And then just see what happens. What happens to a brain fed on that diet? There's a great, important Christian tradition of clear thinking. It began with the Apostle Paul. When you read Paul, like this therefore that our passage started with today, Paul's trying to give you the necessary pieces of information to track his arguments. He's appealing to your mind because he knows that right thinking leads to right living. He knows that transformation here occurs through a renewal of this. He knows that we believe and accept a tremendous amount of lies. Lies about who we are, about what's important, about what's valuable, what it takes to be happy. And all of these things shape our being, our person. And so if you want to reshape your person, you need to pay attention to your mind. Oz Guinness writes a little book called Fit Bodies, Fat Minds, and he starts it by saying he was given a lecture and there was a person in the audience, one of these fitness buffs, and said, you know, sir, my question is, how's your body? And he says, Madame, my question for you is, how is your mind? You know, and for him, a good Brit that he is, he's like, this American culture has got it backwards. They're all worried about how fit their bodies are. And they've thrown their mind to the wayside. That's something you have a responsibility for. You are 100% responsible for what you intake. And your transformation is tied to the renewing of your mind. Now, it's not all just information. There's a danger there. There's a trap there, especially for us brainiacs. Paul is not a man who lived in his mind. You can meet people like this, people who live in their mind. That's not what Paul is counseling. There's no way to read Paul and say, here's a guy who lived in his mind. What's he say? 3 times left for dead, beaten, shipwrecked, blah, blah, blah. Like this man was very active and engaged in whatever he was thinking. So these are the two things, the two answers. It's a twofold answer. Sorry, did I skip over the commit yourself? I did. So Paul has this answer. How then should we live? It's you commit yourselves, your whole body, to God. You don't need a law. You just take everything you are, your bank account, your work, your friends, your social time, you're eating, etc., etc., etc. You all bring it in and you just say, God, this is all yours. I offer it to you. It's a living sacrifice, so it's renewable and renewed. It's holy. It's set apart unto God. And that's the first step, the first answer. How then should we live? The second answer is that because there's a tendency to be distorted in that by what we think, to be transformed through the renewing of our mind. And then, and that's verses 1 and 2. Then you don't need a law. Now, let's confess, let's be honest, the law is much simpler, right? Do you really want to give God absolutely everything, all the time, minute by minute, second by second? That's a lot. Be much better to just be able to say, yeah, I loved my neighbor, click, I did this, click, check it off, and then I'm good, the rest of the time's mine, right? Of course, you know what Jesus thought about that because his conversations with the Pharisees point out the error in that thinking. One special way, a matter of thinking that we need to be transformed by through the renewing of our mind, Paul treats separately, and these two, offer yourselves a living sacrifice, be transformed through the renewing of your mind, and the extension of the renewal of the mind in verse 3, these form the basis for all the rest of the practical teaching that Paul gives. They're sort of an outworking. So what that would mean in this case, do this or look at that. And Paul is very clearly reiterating the things he's told us before. To walk by the Spirit. Those who live according to the flesh have set their mind on the things of the flesh. Those who live according to the Spirit, mind the Spirit. Those who are the sons of God are led by the Spirit of God. And so again, and repeats in other parts of Paul's scriptures. So it's very clear he's sort of consolidating all this teaching and thinking in these two points. But the third one, the third piece, which is an extension of the second piece, is we need to be clear on thinking about who we are and the measure of the faith that God has given us. We very often, because we know certain things, we can very often get ahead of God and ourselves. Let me give you a quick example of that. When I was a young man out of high school, there was an economic crunch back, first time all the housing markets fell flat or something like that. Oil crisis, there was some kind of crisis, and there was no jobs. And so I ended up in Edmonton, and I ended up selling encyclopedias door to door. I should say I tried to sell encyclopedias door to door. And I told myself, and my culture told me, you can be anything you want to be the best you can be. And I was like, yeah, best foot forward, I'm just going to do this. Everyone can do it, other guys can do it. On my team of six or eight people, there was one guy, he'd come back, he'd sell 10 or 11 each night. I could not sell encyclopedias. And me thinking I could was a mistake. I was not in touch with who I was. And I wasn't in touch with what God was doing in my life, but I wasn't seriously trying to follow God at that time, so that was all good. You know. I sold one set of encyclopedias, it went like this. I knocked on a door, a guy said, what, you're selling encyclopedias? I've always wanted an encyclopedia set. Come on in. And I was like, wow, if only they could all be like that. So we need to know ourselves. Again, here's something that we can be responsible to. So if you want to commit to what you're putting into your mind, be intentional and deliberate about a discernment about who has God called you to be. It takes time and patience. It takes some stillness. It takes setting aside some time. What we do instead is we put our eye on the thing that we think we should be or that we want to be, and then we run with that. But Paul says, let each man or woman think soberly with sound judgment according to the measure of the faith that God has given them, so that when they exercise their gifts, they do it according to the grace given them. And we've got potentially round pegs and square holes and square pegs and round holes, and they should just be swapping. But there's something that doesn't allow that person to choose to be the round peg. And so they are in denial. They're like Kierkegaard tells us, they're in despair, unwilling to be the self that they are, trying to be the self that they aren't. That's, for Paul at least, a significant piece of getting our thinking right and the transformation that occurs, because that has a direct impact on our ability to get along with each other, right? If I'm trying to be someone I'm not, that's always going to make my relationship with you a little weird, right? And then if you're trying to be someone you're not, there's no chance for a relationship, really. We're just play acting, you know, we might as well be on a stage somewhere. So Paul, who believes very clearly in the gifts that we all possess, anointed by the one Spirit, a diversity of gifts, wants to see those gifts released, but he knows in Rome and in Corinth, because we get an extended treatment of this image of the body, which I used for my children's talk, extended treatment of the image of the body is a way to correct people trying to be what they're not and trying to adopt or not trying to, adopting the values and cultures of the false world in which they live, the false values. Right? I'm a rich person, so I get to tell people what to do. Well, that may not be God's plan. God might want the poor person to be the one up front talking. And so the kingdom of heaven is revolutionary and radical in all cultures and all settings, all races, all classes, all educations. You have a responsibility both to be willing to know what God thinks of you and to discover that, and then to bring that as your offering according to the measure of faith given, according to the grace of God. That's an exciting picture for a body of believers, for a local community of God followers, something you can be involved in. Paul believes very clearly and is quite confident that there is something for you to be doing, and he's encouraging you, and I am reiterating that. Start that process. Get to know who you are. Get to know what God has done to prepare you and how he's calling you, and then run with that according to what God has given. Let the one who's giving give with the generosity of Christ, right? Let the one who's preaching speak in the faith that he's been given. Let the one who leads with the diligence that God has given them. That's the very clear next three verses there, 6 to 8 in Romans 8. I think that's an exciting vision for us as a parish, and maybe so among us, according to God's mercy and grace. Amen.